It's 9:06, and this is New Hampshire Public Radio.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here's some sound from the news of the week that you heard on NHPR.
I am running for Congress to give New Hampshire a stronger voice in Washington on the things that really matter to us. Things like smaller government, lower taxes, more freedom.
A person who is financially eligible, and age eligible obviously, needn't work at all, can stay at home on the hammock, and doesn't have to do anything? Is that the situation? That simply because you're alive and poor, you receive this health care, and you don't have to do any work if you don't wish
to. Iberdrola has announced as part of a contract between six wind farms to sell up to 565 megawatts of electricity to the Bay State. The power would come from the Wild Meadows Wind Farm, proposed for a ridgeline spanning the towns of Alexandria, Danbury, and Bradford.
Every day, the negative impacts of this federal shutdown grows on my state. Right now, for instance, while our National Guardsmen and women have been recalled, we are facing in the Guard budget shortfalls that make it difficult for them to pay for basic utilities and supplies.
Tower owns Pro Sports of Campton, which operates the 22 campgrounds in the White Mountain National Forest. And Monday, he got his notice.
We are directed now to close the gates as of Thursday, the 10th, unless something happens in Congress.
That was Republican 1st District Congressional candidate Dan Ennis announcing his run, State Representative Neil Kirk on Medicaid expansion, NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown reporting on a proposed wind farm, Governor Maggie Hassan on the Diane Rehm Show discussing the government shutdown, and campground owner Kent Tower talking with NHPR North Country reporter Chris Jensen. With the Columbus Day holiday, New Hampshire tourism officials made extra efforts to reassure visitors that there will be no barricades blocking their enjoyment of white mountain foliage and that state campgrounds are open. Meanwhile, furloughed federal workers at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard were allowed back on the job on Tuesday, but the closure of the U.S. Geological Survey meant that residents of central New Hampshire last night couldn't get official government confirmation of a possible earthquake in their area, although on social media, many people reported feeling some shaking around 9 p.m. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you this hour. We want your thoughts and questions about the headlines of the week. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. Our guests for this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua. Kevin, great to see you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Amory Timmons, reporter for The Concord Monitor. And Amory, welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Always good to see you, too.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Well, all of you, I'll start with you, Dean. Fallout from the partial government shutdown continues, although, as I just said, lots of workers were allowed back at the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard this week. What did we see around New Hampshire this week, Dean, especially leading up to the big Columbus Day weekend?
Right. The obvious concern at the moment for New Hampshireites, and particularly New Hampshire businesses, is tourism. This is, I think, the third biggest weekend of the year in terms of tourist dollars for New Hampshire because of the foliage. So there was some concern about campgrounds having to be closed in national forests. Some concern about whether or not people would have access to the national parks, et cetera. Parks are closed, but you can still get into the forest because they have highways that run through them. And there was this discussion, as we heard in the opening, about whether or not these 22 campgrounds in New Hampshire would be open. And I think at least some of them will be open. And we've also seen a number of furloughed workers at the Naval Shipyard, National Guard, being called back into service, which is obviously helpful. But, you know, there are sort of more insidious, longer-term concerns about, you know, the rebounding housing market and the impact of a slowdown in federal mortgages, product manufacturing and ability to have inspectors look at products before they're shipped. So there have been a number of these stories floating around over the last week or so. The bigger context is there seems to be some movement, at least on the debt ceiling issue coming up on October 17th. The big question is going to be whether that debt ceiling agreement is tied into some sort of movement on the shutdown.
Right. And we heard those headlines this morning. And not to spend too much time on the Columbus Day Thursday weekend and foliage and so forth, Kevin. But as Dean points out, it is super important. I think a lot of people, especially maybe outside New Hampshire, don't understand the difference between a national forest and a national park. So they hear these stories, you know, Grand Canyon is closed, and they think, oh, I can't go up to the White Mountains this weekend. But it's very different.
It is very different, and obviously a lot of federal trails through the White Mountain National Forest up there are going to be open. A lot of these private campgrounds that are on federal property are actually some of the most popular stops for out-of-state tourists, and it's really because they provide not only wonderful views and good vistas, but they're pretty easy to camp facility. I would call it Dolly Cop Campground.
Yeah, it's a nice one.
Is one of them in particular that we spent a lot of time when I was growing up in the North Country there on weekends. While people who are outdoor enthusiasts are more likely to choose a more rigorous outing, and those wouldn't be on those campgrounds, and all those folks, of course, will be up this weekend.
What other impacts have you seen, Kevin, this week around New Hampshire? And then, Anne-Marie, I want you on this, too.
Well, I think actually this very much parallels the 95 shutdown in this respect. I mean, there was a lot of anticipation in 95 when the shutdown first occurred. There were going to be all these horrendous impacts, and it took over a week for many of them to be fully known. I think Dean mentioned home mortgages, and that's a real big concern. And with the debt limit being combined with this, I just noted out there there's a lot of frustration and growing anger among the public that these folks can't get together.
Sort of unease.
Right. And so, but there's no question that families throughout New Hampshire are impacted by it, whether it's federal employees or people waiting for a mortgage or trying to get a small business administration loan. It's a lot less convenient than it is right now dealing with the federal government. Even congressional staffs, many of them don't have as many people working for them as they did before the shutdown.
What are you hearing, Anne-Marie?
It's been interesting. About a week or a little more ago, one of our reporters, Megan Doyle, went out and tried to talk to people. You know, what do you think of this? And we ran into so many people who said, shutdown? Is it a state shutdown? Federal? They really weren't engaged. And, you know, as I listened to the national news reports, I think New Hampshire is a little different because we don't have a huge federal employee situation here where
right, about 4,000 people total.
Yeah, and it's not like Concord or one of our other big cities necessarily depends on those workers being on the job to keep the local deli going or the gas stations going. And so I think it's been a little different here. I think people are starting to pay attention more, and they're, you know, we certainly are hearing from folks who are angry and, you know, blaming both sides and frustrated.
So as it goes on, Emory, you're hearing from more people about it than last week.
Yeah, people are more tuned in now and getting angry. And
well, one of the areas where this has come up is in state politics. And Dean Spiliotis, U.S. Senate candidate Jim Rubens, a Republican from the Upper Valley, has been stepping up his campaign with lots of events all over the state. And he issued his ideas last week on the shutdown. I want to share them with you guys and then get your thoughts on them. He's obviously putting out press releases on all sorts of issues, as any candidate would. So here's what Jim Rubin says. He says, pass a clean continuing resolution, delay implementation of the Unaffordable Care Act, those are his words, obviously, by 1 year, and adopt a federal debt limit increase sufficient to pay the nation's bills for another year. Then he says, during the one-year window, Congress should adopt the super committee long-term budget approach and expand the super committee's purview to include finding a replacement for, again, what he calls the Unaffordable Care Act. So Dean Spiliotis seems to be trying to carve a middle ground there, or what? What's your thought on that?
Right, and obviously now that he's an announced candidate for the Senate, he's going to of necessity comment on whatever is happening in Washington at the moment. So this is a good opportunity for him to try to get some visibility. You know, I think the biggest sticking point for his approach is this idea of delaying Obamacare 1 year. The administration has said that's absolutely not going to happen because they see that as a slippery slope to essentially repealing it or scuttling it in some fashion. You know, the idea is that among some Republicans, anyways, that if you postpone it for a year. that gives you basically buys you time to figure out how to essentially repeal it or reform it. Now, I don't know what Jim Rubin's motivation for that 1 year delay is, but that has been the concern of the administration. So, you know, I think that aspect of his position is a non-starter as far as the administration is concerned. You know, there has been some movement. I think, you know, we've seen over the last few days a couple of polls, particularly a Wall Street Journal poll that shows Republicans are taking a pretty significant hit in terms of the blame for the shutdown. I think they're sort of 22% over Democrats in the Wall Street Journal poll. So we're starting to see some movement. I think the hope among our congressional delegation, that would be Democrats in the House and then Republican Kelly Ayotte and Democrat Jeanne Shaheen in the Senate, is that there'll be a more comprehensive solution that will raise the debt ceiling. And that will be in conjunction with opening government. What Speaker Boehner has proposed is raising the debt ceiling and then having a more comprehensive process for appropriations, but not necessarily reopening the government. And Kelly Ayotte has been in the news recently encouraging Susan Collins in the Senate and others who are working on this kind of grand compromise. But I think our members of the House would prefer that as well, rather than simply raising the ceiling but not opening government.
Kevin, also your thoughts on how New Hampshire's delegation and, as I just said, New Hampshire's candidates for Congress are reacting, responding to this.
Yeah, the delegation is reacting pretty predictable ways. Democrats supporting the president and condemning the shutdown, blaming Republicans. Republicans blaming the Democrats for not allowing us to even discuss Obamacare as part of a global solution. There's not a lot of difference there. What's interesting about Rubin's position, essentially, I think that's what we're going to see from this candidate. He's always been a thoughtful, fiscal conservative, social moderate. But in this campaign, he really is appealing and trying to ignite the Tea Party base in the party, the libertarian, very fiscally conservative folks. And they want Obamacare on the agenda. They insist it be there. So I'm not at all surprised to see him very much mirror what many of the very conservative House Republicans were saying early on about this problem.
All right. And after a super short break, one more political note. This week, Dan Innes made it official, running as a Republican for the 1st Congressional District. We'll talk about that after a short break. We invite your questions and comments to give us a call. Your questions, comments, thoughts about some of the big news items of the week. The number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. More news of the week coming up.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And there are just a few days left to wrap up the NHPR Sustaining Member Challenge. You may have received a letter about this. When you become a sustainer today, you're going to help us meet the challenge and claim $10,000 from the Mackinich Foundation and cancel a day from our fall fund drive. Join the family of sustaining members today at NHPR.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from People's United Bank, offering a full line of services to help individuals, businesses, and communities succeed. People's United Bank, would know how can do, member FDIC, equal housing lender. From the McLean Law Firm and its family law group for divorce and annulments, prenuptial agreements, adoption, and legal separations, online at mclane.com. And Small Dog Electronics, offering Dr. Small Dog house calls for home and business, Mac and PC, technical service and repair, online at smalldog.com/doctor. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're looking at some of the top headlines of the week. We've talked about the continued fallout from the partial federal government shutdown. A little bit later, we'll talk about the special commission studying Medicaid and what it recommended this week. Also, the state's gambling commission heard from a former FBI investigator. We'll hear more about that. And we'll look at a story that's caused headlines in Nashua, where an elementary school banned the game of tag. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. And just before the break, we were talking politics. Jim Rubin's, his campaign for the U.S. Senate. Dean Spiliotis, someone else made it official this week, Dan Innes, running as a Republican for the 1st Congressional District. Just to give us a quick bio there.
Sure. And Dan Innes is the dean of the UNH Business School. He is going to step down from that position, obviously, to run as a Republican candidate in the 1st Congressional District. He's never run for office before. He's been in academia for about 2 decades. He's 50 years old. He is a gay married Republican. He and his husband own an inn in Portsmouth. We haven't heard that much from him so far. We've heard fairly standard themes: smaller government, lower taxes, greater liberties, fairly sort of boilerplate Republican comments. He is the dean of a business school, so you would think he would have some opinions about repealing Obamacare and the debt ceiling, et cetera. Have not heard anything from him on that yet.
Yeah, he just jumped in this week, though, right. So we'll probably hear a lot more.
They'll press him for it, yeah.
Your thoughts on this this coming contest between now, at least, in the 1st District on the Republican side, Dan Innes and Frank Ginta?
Well, one thing that interested me in the early reporting was the fact that he is married to another man and whether that was going to be part of the race. I think it will be, just by the sake that reporters are asking this. It may not take anyone to introduce it into the race. I think it's, you know, in a way, some people, not the extreme part of the Republican Party, but I think the Republican Party in this state could very well embrace that sort of demographic. It's something they've not had, and they've been criticized for not embracing. But I don't think at this point in New Hampshire, whether you're gay or straight, has a tremendous effect on most of the voters here.
All right. Again, our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, let's go to the phones. And Josh is calling from Penacook. Hi, Josh. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Laura.
Sure.
I just had a question for the political commentators, and I guess all your guests. About what do you think the likelihood of Speaker Boehner possibly losing his job or having some sort of repercussion on his political career for not allowing a vote to go to the floor for the members to vote on?
Josh, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, Kevin or Dean, you want to jump in on that, Kevin?
Yeah, that's certainly an interesting question. A lot of the Beltway talk is that a lot of Speaker Boehner's actions to this point throughout this shutdown debate have really been about surviving in the Republican caucus after 2014. It's very unclear what the House is going to look like. Certainly, probably 6-8 months ago, it looked like there might be more Republicans elected in the U.S. House in a midterm election for Obama, but the margin could be quite closer. What's interesting, too, is, of course, Boehner has a number of very experienced politicians in his inner circle, many of which are pretty politically ambitious. And as we saw with former Speaker Tom Foley, when he ran into trouble and ultimately did not seek election, when a speaker becomes weakened, there's all kinds of folks on Capitol Hill in either party perfectly happy to take advantage of that and become their opponent and try and force them out. I think Boehner's under a lot of pressure right now, and it's very apparent.
Dean, you want to jump in super quick?
Sure. You know, I mean, basically, Kevin pretty much said it all. There has been this discussion about whether or not the reason why he's preventing a clean continuing resolution from going to the House is because he's concerned that in the Republican caucus, which currently is the majority, he's going to lose sufficient support to be Speaker. And the whole House of Representatives votes for Speaker of the House every 2 years, but the majority caucus essentially typically controls who the Speaker is going to be. So, you know, to have this sort of 40 or 50 Tea Party affiliated members of Congress unhappy with him is a risk. I don't know that that's the only thing driving it, and we don't know, as Kevin said, what the makeup is going to be after 2014, but it's certainly in the mix.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Josh. And the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And here's an email that came in from Becky in Gorham talking about our earlier conversation on the effects of the shutdown in the White Mountain National Forest. Becky says, clarification, campgrounds on the White Mountain National Forest are not privately owned, as your guest stated. They are federally owned and on public land. The private company Pro Sports is contracted to manage the day-to-day operations. Becky, thanks for the clarification. We appreciate it. Clarifications, questions, and comments are welcome. Again, at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Amory Timmons, I want to ask you about a story that I need a lot of clarification on because it's complicated, and it's Medicaid expansion. We have talked about this almost weekly on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. A special committee has been meeting for several months now, took a vote this week, Amory, on what it called a New Hampshire solution. Can you clarify this for us, please?
I'll try.
Yeah.
My understanding is that they have voted to go ahead to say, let's expand with this caveat that if you are eligible to get insurance through your employer, that you have to seek that first, and you will get some assistance in paying that, perhaps, but you have to take that step first. And I think there is a majority of votes on the expansion commission to go in that direction.
Right. Go ahead, Kevin. Yeah.
Right. The biggest change that really occurred from what both Governor Hassan and House Speaker Terry Norelli had warned with expansion is it makes this private insurance not optional but mandatory. Back when we started, the governor was willing to have this offered to people, but not required of these folks. This report will say that they're required. Now, it's important to point out that ultimately it's the state's decision whether these folks are enrolled in this assistance program. If the state finds that it's not cost-effective for the state to provide Medicaid to wrap around this private coverage, then they won't be in this program. They'll then default to Medicaid. And they'll go into one of the three managed care organizations that are going to be starting up to provide care for them. And certainly if you look at the estimates and forecasts of consultants that have worked for the Department of Health and Human Services, they conclude that a lot of these folks are not going to be cost effective, mainly because that private insurance is so minimalist that it's provided by the employer, and it doesn't have the benefits that are going to be required under Medicaid with the Affordable Care Act.
Let's take another call if we could. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. And Brad's calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Brad. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about that Medicaid issue. I saw a really interesting article in the Portsmouth Herald last week in which two members of that commission, Helen Taft and Tom Sherman, expressed the view that Medicaid participants should not be forced onto the health care exchanges. And I quote what one of them said was, because of the limited number of participating hospitals due to Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield's structuring of the plans. And as a small business person and taxpayer, I find that fascinating because next year, when my current policy runs out, I will be forced onto the exchange. And I'll be forced to deal with what they offer on the exchange. Now, I've tried to get in there and see what my policy will cost me next year. No success there yet. But my friend of mine with an office down the hall, I sat and watched him do it. He did get through. We're about the same age. He's looking at a 60% increase next year. And that's to include Portsmouth Hospital. We both live and work in Portsmouth. If he didn't include Portsmouth Hospital, it's only a 40% increase. What a bargain. But, I mean, the irony here is that we're taxpayers. We're paying for Medicaid patients to get health care. But they are not going to be inconvenienced by going to the exchange. I guess they're too busy. But we are going to be forced onto it. I just wonder if that's my interpretation of that is true and what the comments on that would be. Thank you.
So you feel like, Brad, Medicaid, people covered by Medicaid are getting a better deal than you are having to deal with the exchanges.
Yeah, obviously. And according to what I'm reading in the paper, that sounds like it. And I'm really quite perturbed by that since I just wrote my quarterly check last month to the IRS.
Brad, thanks a lot for calling in. Dean?
Sure, absolutely. You know, and this fits into the larger narrative of all the problems that have popped up over the initial days of the healthcare exchanges. You know, my understanding of the current proposal is that they would in fact need a waiver from the federal government in order to force some of these individuals onto the not necessarily the caller's case, but in terms of, you know, the choice between going to Medicaid or going through the private exchange if you are getting health care from an employer, because you need two carriers in the marketplace in order to do this. And right now we only have Anthem in the marketplace. But my guess is they probably would be able to get the waiver. You know, it's hard to speak to an individual, to you know, Brad's individual case. But You know, I've also heard stories of people who have gone on to the exchange, the ones who have been able to, and you know, gotten coverage for reasonably low cost. You know, the big issue is going to be, and this is an argument that Republicans have made, and similar to what Brad is saying, that one of the concerns is that it will increasingly become cost effective for employers to push their employees into these exchanges, and then they can just sort of wipe their hands of having to deal with providing insurance. That essentially you decouple the provision of insurance from employment, and it sounds like that's what Brad is concerned about.
Kevin?
Yeah, Brad, it's important to point out that with this proposal that these folks will have to enroll in the exchange if they're not deemed eligible for the premium assistance program before Medicaid becomes the last option. As Dean pointed out, because New Hampshire only has one insurer on the exchange, Medicaid will not allow these folks to be in the exchange in New Hampshire. We'd have to obtain a waiver for it. This is likely going to be one of the biggest kind of stress points, if you will, once we go from this commission report to the legislature. There are certainly Republicans in the state Senate that want to direct the Department of Health and Human Services to apply for a waiver to allow New Hampshire to be determined an eligible state on the exchange under Medicaid. After all, we only have one insurer there, but there are 11 health plans of a variety of sorts. And as we've talked about many times here in this program before, New Hampshire is a very small market with a very dominant insurer, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield New Hampshire. That's becoming more dominant in successive years. I mean, and we also have Harvard Community Health Plan already expressing interest in being on the exchange in 2015. Keeping in mind, of course, that the state of Arkansas was able to get a waiver to allow all their people on this Medicaid expansion from 0 to 138% of federal poverty on the exchange. This only would allow a segment of our folks to be on the exchange, not the poorest of the poor.
Well, Brad, thanks for calling, for sharing your story. It's good to hear from you. And there certainly is a shakeout underway with this new health care law. As we talk about this special Medicaid commission, another special commission has also been meeting at the State House, Anne-Marie, the Gambling Commission. Now, it's been a while since we talked about this one on this Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. So just remind us where this comes from. Why are we looking at gambling again? I thought we killed that.
Right. Governor Maggie Hassan had really wanted gambling to be part of her budget. There was not enough time in the session to get that through. The proposals did not make it through as a compromise. There was this idea, well, let's look at putting some rules in place maybe, because one of the complaints was, how do we pass gambling if we don't even know what the rules are going to be or the regulations? So this commission, over the course of the summer and still now, is looking at, well, what kind of structure can we put in place? And they heard this week from a man who was very involved in Pennsylvania's setup. And in Pennsylvania, it's structured quite a bit differently. And I took a trip down to Pennsylvania, as did Emily Corwin from here.
Oh, really?
To look at it. And I think we both came away understanding that Pennsylvania has done it very, very differently. And the people in Pennsylvania seem to be very happy with the way it's been done. And so this person recommended New Hampshire follow that process, which is make the regulatory agency totally separate from the lottery or the paramutual commission. Give them the resources to really do their job. And the other thing that Pennsylvania has done, and I'll be curious to see if we approach it here, is to really increase the tax rate on net earnings. It was going to be 30% or lower here. Pennsylvania is at 55%.
Oh, boy, that's a big difference.
It's a lot higher. And it's really directed to the host town, but also to the hosting community for economic development. It's really specific. It can't just be used for tax reduction. It has to be used for growing. And so I thought it was interesting that they heard from the Pennsylvania person, because that is a process down there that people seem to think is going well.
Kenneth McCabe, a former FBI guy, mm-hmm. who said, Anne-Marie, that he had the same concerns that a lot of opponents have had about crime. And what did he have to say about that here in New Hampshire this week?
He found, this was true of the folks in Pennsylvania, that it just didn't come to fruition. It was not something they saw. And I heard this again and again when I was in Pennsylvania, that the casinos there seek the regulation and welcome the regulation because it's bad for business to have all sorts of crime associated with your establishment. And I went down to visit the casino that Millennium has there. They were looking at a license here. And they have security, their own security on staff. They have state police on the site. They have regular checks. And they say they don't have any interest in having a criminal reputation because it's just terrible for business.
Dean, you want to jump in
there? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, one of the criticisms of the whole push for casino gambling in New Hampshire was that it was problematic to be pushing for the legislation and the licensing at the same time you're developing the regulatory framework. So, you know, all of this is really geared towards having a lot of, you know, having all the sort of regulatory ducks in a row in terms of how to proceed. But I have no idea whether this is going to ultimately make a difference in terms of whether or not we actually get casino gambling. You know, I read the coverage and I read sort of the commentary by the legislators. And then I remind myself, this hasn't been passed. This is all sort of based on the assumption that, well, you know, maybe if they can show that they understand how the regulatory process should work, that will change some minds. Now, maybe Kevin and Anne-Marie know, but I've seen no evidence that it really is going to make a difference. It might, but we don't know.
That's a question I had too, Kevin. I mean, the presumption is, well, if we can just show a really good regulatory structure, then, you know, X percent of people who were opposed before will all of a sudden support. And I think Dean makes a good point. It's unclear whether that's really going to happen or not.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, there's obviously a lot of people who are philosophically opposed to a casino. There are also folks who don't think it's a dependable revenue source, that in down economic times, this is discretionary income. We saw during the last recession a lot of layoffs and very poor performances by the casino industry throughout the country. So those certainly are going to remain. One of the interesting things with regard to the tax rate that Anne-Marie mentioned, and it did turn a lot of heads at the commission that was looking at this, is New Hampshire chose a different route for a different reason. If you remember, Governor Hassan said, I need $80 million license fee from this casino to balance this budget. You recall, if I don't get this $80 million, there's going to have to be draconian cuts to Health and Human Services, et cetera, et cetera. In Pennsylvania, they have two resort casinos that are sort of like the one New Hampshire would develop. They only require a $5 million license fee.
Wow, that's a big difference.
And that's why they're able to do that, ask for less money up front in order to get a lot more money year after year after year.
Okay, while we're talking about state budgets, Kevin, real quickly before the break, the state government announced a surplus this week, words that we're not used to hearing in the same sentence, given all the concern about deficits of recent years. How big was it, and how did this happen?
Well, it's a $19 million surplus, and it $2 billion state budget, so that's not a lot of dollars. But as you point out, I mean, even a couple of months ago, we were talking about a $30 or $40 million deficit ending this year. We got a couple of things that New Hampshire's famous for, frankly, found money. A settlement with an oil company gave us $9 million. A settlement with tobacco companies gave us over $20 million. Those certainly helped. And pretty good fiscal management by the state departments that returned a lot more money to the Treasury than they were asked to.
All right. Well, after a short break, I might ask all of you what Governor Hassan and lawmakers say they want to do with this money, because there's been some controversy about that. I also want to ask you about, again, that story in Nashua, no more tag at a school in Nashua, and plan to build an ice rink at Strawberry Bank. So all that's coming up. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
When we hear from 500 new sustaining members by October 15th, we'll collect $10,000 from the Mackininch Foundation and cancel a day from our upcoming fall fund drive. We're asking you to join NHPR's sustaining member family by donating $5 or $10 a month to NHPR through your credit card or bank account. Just take a couple of minutes when you call 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Sugar Hill Sampler in Sugar Hill, a shop featuring quilts, home decor, gourmet food and candy, and a museum spanning two centuries of local facts, photos and folklore, sugarhillsampler.com. And Hinckley Allen Attorneys at Law, who believe a lawyer should also understand your business. More information about Hinckley Allen and the clients they serve is online at hinckleyallen.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we want to hear from you, your questions and comments about some of the top stories that we're talking about this week. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Just before the break, all of you, Kevin Landrigan was filling us in on a small state surplus, $19 million, Kevin said. What's been the conversation, Dean Spiliotis, at the State House about what to do with this surplus? I mean, a lot of people are saying, just sock it away, save it, you're going to need it someday.
Right. I mean, there's been a pretty predictable response and division between Republicans and Democrats. Governor Hassan and Speaker Norelli want to use some of the money to restore budget cuts, particularly to these sort of non-specified cuts to the Department of Health and Human Services for social services. There are also these unspecified cuts to state staff and benefits. I think it's about $25 million in total that were put into the budget. So maybe they can kind of take away some of that. And then put a little bit of money in the rainy day fund, the savings fund, essentially, which is sort of a $9 million fund, I think. Right now, there's a concern that that's too low. I will say that Speaker Norelli said, this would be good to do, but let's not tinker with the budget agreement too much. And you think we just spent a whole cycle getting to this sort of grand compromise that everybody was happy with. Republicans particularly want to save the money rather than spend it. It's just sort of human nature. When you get some additional money to play with, you go back and look and see what you might be able to restore. But my guess is perhaps there'll be some of that. But I think there is going to be pressure to not tinker with what everybody thought was a good agreement.
Yeah. And I want to move on to another story that made headlines here on NHPR and in other media this week. And this is New Hampshire wind developer Iberdrola. It's a Spanish-owned company, but it has offices here in New Hampshire. Announced this week that it would like to sell some of its power to Massachusetts so Massachusetts can reach its green power hopes or goals. This is the Wild Meadows project. Dean, it's not approved yet. So are they putting the cart before the horse here or what?
Yeah, I'm sort of not an expert on the regulatory process for alternative energy, but it feels a little bit that way. They have not submitted a plan to the site review committee yet in the state. This is interesting. When I read this story, the first thing I thought of was this is going to be kind of another public relations issue like the Northern Pass, where it's, let's take energy from somewhere else or either New Hampshire or somewhere else and send it to a different state in New England. For me, these wind projects are just fascinating because it really is a test of people's willingness to explore renewable energy. Everybody wants renewable energy, less dependence on fossil fuels. But then when you encounter the reality, and this particular project is 37 towers. Each tower is 40 stories tall, lighted turbine. These are huge turbines on ridge lines near Newfound Lake and Cardigan Mountain. And I've spent, as probably all of you have, spent a fair bit of time in Newfound Lake and a fair bit of time on top of Cardigan Mountain. That's a pretty significant alteration to the view, and I think there's going to be there is in fact tremendous opposition among residents. So it's kind of a double whammy. People saying you sign this 15-year lease to give power to Massachusetts. How does that help New Hampshire? And on top of that, you have the classic debate about damaging pristine views and wilderness.
Well, and Emery Timmons, I wanted to give your paper, the Concord Monitor, a shout out. The Forum, which is sort of the area of your paper where you ask readers to submit their comments, their thoughts, their essays. You guys did something pretty recently on wind power, and I thought it was really interesting. Just give us a sense of some of the sentiment that came through on that.
We certainly heard from the kinds of folks that Dean just mentioned, the people who thought this was a blight on the landscape. Also, that this is going to Massachusetts, that's never a good public relations argument to have to make. But we also heard, we did get one sort of poetic piece from someone who thought these were just the most beautiful sort of structures she has seen. I believe she does not live near one, and there was some pushback from folks who said, well, why don't you come stay with me and hear the sound of it and see it all the time. I think what's going to be interesting is, that we do have this push in New Hampshire from some to be more green, but they don't want wind. They're opposed to Northern Pass. At some point, what is the acceptable solution to this problem? And this is the kind of thing where you when you talk about Northern Pass or wind and you talk about it with people beyond New Hampshire, you realize that this is a regional question, not just a state question. And these kinds of issues really broaden the question about are we working together as a region or just as a state here?
Right. That's a good point, because our power here, our electricity, is all managed and distributed by ISO New England, so the independent system operator. So you're right, it is a regional issue. I wanted to ask you, Kevin Landergan, about a very local issue, and this is over on the seacoast. Strawberry Bank, a beloved historical site in Portsmouth, wants to build an ice skating rink. What are some of the hopes around that, Kevin, that what this ice skating rink may bring to the institution, to the city, you know, visions of Rockefeller Center and so forth?
Yeah, certainly. It's a pretty ambitious proposal by Strawberry Bank to build this ice rink and make it not only a community resource but an attraction for people who love ice skating. There's talk of professional ice shows being held there, as well as offering the ice rink for community skating, for pickup hockey games. The problem, of course, is that we're talking about probably the most historic section of Portsmouth in the South End, and a number of residents are very opposed to this, are already in court challenging the city's right to grant a variance for the rink. So it certainly has touched off quite a local controversy.
Well, and from Seacoast Online, neighbors contend the proposed ice skating rink, the Puddle Dock Pond, will ruin the unique character of the city's most historic neighborhood. The mix will bring traffic to an area already plagued with congestion, noise, light pollution, all sorts of concerns by residents there. This seems to be, you know, sort of a classic story, Dean, of, you know, some people saying, hey, this is great, it'll help develop our town, and then others saying, well, yeah, but it's going to disturb me.
Yeah,
it's tough, isn't it?
It's the classic not in my backyard, which everybody has had experience with at some point in their lives. You know, I sort of have mixed feelings, because everywhere I've ever lived, there have been these sorts of outdoor rinks, whether it's downtown Chicago or growing up in New York with skating at Rockefeller Center. You know, I've seen the way in which these kinds of projects, and this one we're talking about, I think, will be up for 3 months a year. It's a temporary rink. Can be an economic boom. They really add to kind of the ambiance of the community. But I know that part of Portsmouth as well, and sort of the thought of sort of the volume of people that it might attract is problematic, and it's fairly common for neighbors in the area to sue or try to block it on grounds of noise pollution, light pollution, traffic, etc.
All right. Well, again, the number for you to join our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup as we look at statewide stories, regional stories, and sometimes interesting local stories is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here's an email that came in from Karen in Amherst responding to the story that I mentioned we'd talk about later, and that's the banning of the game of tag at Charlotte Avenue Elementary School in Nashua. Here's what Karen says. When I lived in New Jersey 9 years ago, I was a substitute teacher. Tag and other chase games were not allowed at the elementary school I worked at. Safety was the reason. Also, no hanging upside down from any playground equipment, no football-style game allowed. She says that only stopped after the only male teacher who played with the kids no longer worked there. Karen and Amherst says, I really wondered then what the world was coming to. This is an interesting story. And Emery Timmons, again, Nashua's not in your coverage district, but I wonder what you think. I'm sure this has gone on elsewhere where people have debated these types of games.
Yeah, I was looking into this morning, and I don't think this got as much news, but Wyndham banned dodgeball in the gym in April. I think this is a real divide. And my husband and I were talking about this morning. He's with the person who wrote, like, what are we coming to? Do we just want kids sitting around on their iPads, not mixing it up and not getting any physical activity?
Yeah, we complain about childhood obesity,
right,
but then we say don't play tag.
As someone who was plagued by bullies on the playground, I would have definitely been happy to have no tag or dodgeball.
So that's the other side of it, Amy.
Yeah, kids who are quiet and afraid to speak up, it is torturous to be the subject. Dodgeball would be my bigger target for banning. I read that some schools are allowing, even cartwheels are, you know, need to be supervised or outlawed. It's very specific, but it's going on in Colorado, Wyoming, Washington, Massachusetts. We're seeing it in a lot of places. Not in Concord yet, as far as I know.
Yeah, interesting. Well, and again, praise for the Nashua Telegraph. They've been covering this. This is where we're getting most of our information. Charlotte Avenue, the Telegraph says, isn't the only area school to prohibit recess games. It says, in Windham, like you said, the school district banned dodgeball and other potentially violent activities. Those were reinstated in July. Some of the names were changed to sound less violent. And the Telegraph says policies about tag vary in the region. At Reed's Ferry Elementary School in Merrimack, the paper says, tag is not explicitly banned, but the school has rules in place that discourage body contact. Kids that do play tag are allowed to yell, "You're it," when they catch another player instead of touching them. That would be tough, Dean, because how do you know? Unless I touch you, how do you? But how do I dictate that you're it?
Right. It'll come up with a game of virtual tag. I have mixed feelings about this. I grew up at a time where, to paraphrase Thomas Hobbes, recess was nasty, brutish, and short. It was a real trial by fire. Basically, a bunch of little boys all kind of bouncing off of each other for a half hour. But I also understand kind of that, you know, we've become an increasingly litigious society. There's a lot of liability issues at stake here. The nature of communities themselves have changed a bit. And so I sort of understand why they're doing it. But this is the kind of story that sort of drives kind of conservatives and libertarians crazy. It's sort of the nanny state at a micro level. There are debates among child psychologists about, you know, what's the reasonable amount to protect your child in terms of, you know, sort of dealing with the world. Tag is something kids have played for generations. But it is increasingly the case, and I see it even here in Concord, where a lot of the kinds of things that were part of the experience of going to school, particularly in recess, are now kind of being sort of pushed off of the school grounds and kind of left for kids to do on their own.
What was that quote again that you gave?
It's Thomas Hobbes, the famous philosopher. The state of nature is nasty, brutish, and short.
And for you, that's what recess was like.
Recess was nasty, brutish. Actually, not all that short. It was a half hour a day.
But, well, and it's tough because, again, Anne-Marie talked about being pushed around. And playgrounds,
right? For example, I remember when I was a kid, our playground was like blacktop with jagged metal swings. We had those merry-go-rounds where you could get dragged underneath, but so it was just a different time.
Okay, well, let me put the other side in there, though. And I can see totally both sides of this. But
sure.
Kevin Landrigan, you know, if my boys don't get time running around like crazy, they get nasty and brutish. So, you know, kids do need a chance to run around.
Yeah, certainly.
Is a fun way to do it.
That's what a lot of parents look forward to recess for, is getting some of that kinetic, hyperactive energy out of them. It always amazes me when stories like this touch such a societal nerve, if you will, much like Anne-Marie, remember the Bearcat story in Concord. This story has generated the most Facebook comments we've ever received about any story we've had before.
Really?
Yes.
All right. Well, we've got a listener or two who wants to chime in on it as well. So let's go back to our calls if we could. Steve's in Manchester. Hi, Steve. We're squeezing you in at the end of the line here. Go ahead.
Hey, I appreciate it. So the game of dodgeball and tag and all that being taken out of schools under the guise of safety or whatever you want to call it, I can't help but wonder if this happens to coincide with the whole every kid gets a trophy, everyone's a winner, and what ramifications that's going to have for future generations down the line.
Scoreless baseball, scoreless soccer, and so forth.
Exactly.
What do you think, Dean? I'll let you handle that one. Thank you, Steve, very much.
Exactly what we were just talking about. This really has touched a cultural nerve between, you know, the sort of the issues of, you know, whether or not we're sort of overprotecting our children from the dangers in the world and kind of the reality of what it's like to live life as you grow older. And then, you know, concerns about the nanny state. And sort of the sort of liability issues and lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. This is a hot button issue. It really kind of gets at sort of core feelings about the role of a community and raising your children, the role of government, et cetera. So I'm not surprised to see that something like this touched a nerve.
All right. And thanks for that call. And let's take one more. This is Cynthia in Portsmouth. Hi, Cynthia. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Cynthia Harbell. I'm actually chair of the board of Strawberry Bank and on the planning committee for Provo.com. I wanted to clarify two issues quickly. We are planning no hockey league. We're planning maybe selective times of the evening for adult stick practice, and on the weekend, selective supervised times for kids for practice. But there'll be no time spent, you know, in hockey league. It's really going to be a family-friendly after-school school lessons for kids to kind of grow skaters. And then secondly, the litigious group of the neighbors are actually 11 households, 15 people. We have a lot of people in the South End that love this idea, that are supporting us. We actually have to do a GoFundMe website recruitment for money to pay our legal fees because we haven't been able to do any fundraising for the rink because we're in this lawsuit. I'm very sorry about the lawsuit. We're hoping to meet with the neighbors again to see if we can come to some compromise.
All right. Well, and Cynthia, sorry to cut you off there. Thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate it. And I'm sure our Seacrest reporter, Emily Corwin, will be following up on this one. Thank you for being with us.
Terrific. Thanks a lot for having me.
Bye-bye. Bye. And all of you, we just have about a minute left, and I like to end this show always by asking you all what you're going to be covering next week. Anne-Marie, what are you going to be working on next week?
I'm trying to follow the efforts to make fish and game more sustainable. There's a commission working on that. Their report is due November 1st.
Because that's a self-funded agency.
Self-funded, and for the first time this past session, they had to put about $1.3 million of general fund money into fish and game. And there's just been a lot of internal debates and external, you know, who is benefiting from our environment? Is it just the people fishing, hunting? It's a tourism benefit. It's hikers, it's paddlers. And how do you share the cost of having all that with all the people who are using it?
That's really interesting because I know hunters and anglers have often felt that they bear most of the cost while others are enjoying the benefits.
Yeah, they're paying for the search and rescue, for example, and they're rarely the ones getting rescued.
How about you, Kevin Landrigan?
I'm a political reporter who's going to be eating his peas, attending the final meeting, we hope, of the Medicaid Commission where they'll be voting on their draft report.
Well, maybe put a little butter and salt on those peas. Maybe they'll taste better. Dean Spiliotis, how about you?
I'm glad Kevin's going to be covering that that committee meeting. I'm going to be looking at the politics of the shutdown for our congressional delegation, and also looking at, obviously, at this race shaping up in the first congressional district Republican primary.
All right, great stuff. Dean Spiliotis, thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civics column in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Emory Timmons, it was great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Emory Timmons, reporter for the Concord Monitor. And Kevin Landrigan, thank you also for your time. We always appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
Kevin Landrigan, political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. There are just days left in NHPR's Sustaining Member Challenge. You can help us collect $10,000 from the Mackininch Foundation by becoming a sustainer now. So if you've received a letter from us in the mail about it, and even if you haven't, please become a sustainer for just $5 or $10 a month. You'll help NHPR collect $10,000 and cancel a day from our fall member drive. Call 1-888-805-6477 or visit nhpr.org.
Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, hosting a community lecture on arthritis management with Dr. Moby Parsons, October 30th at 6 p.m. at Frisbee Hospital, sosmed.org. And New Hampshire Community College is offering classes with an October start date. Details at ccsnh.edu/late start for class listings and locations.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nassau 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
from WAMU and NPR in Washington. I'm Diane Rehm. White House officials and House Republicans met last night to discuss reopening the government and increasing the country's debt limit. No deal reached, but the meeting is the most positive sign of a possible thaw in the budget standoff that's consumed long.